Hi, I'm Elise.
I'm Loz, and welcome to Podwraith, a Star Trek Deep Space Nine podcast. If this is your first time joining us, we're two different friends watching Star Trek Deep Space Nine and sharing both our deep and irreverent, and sometimes irrelevant, thoughts on our favourite Star Trek series. You'll notice that I am not Matt.
I don't know if I ever said this to embarrass Matt a little bit. I think a couple times when we first started the pod, he would accidentally say irrelevant, and it was just really funny. Like, I think it got out there a couple times he caught it and said irreverent.
Well, he's in good company with Terry Farrell in that case.
This week, we're talking about Season 4, Episode 25, Body Parts, teleplay by Hans Beimler and directed by Avery Brooks. Body Parts aired on June 10th, 1996.
This week on Deep Space Nine, when Quark learns that he is dying, he auctions his vacuum-desiccated body to raise capital. Meanwhile, an accident on a mission prompts Dr. Bashir to transfer Keiko's baby into Major Kira.
So, in addition to watching this very silly episode that I'm just going to preemptively say we both really like, because we chatted about it, I have been watching the 2021 documentary narrated by Gates McFadden, The Center Seat, 55 Years of Star Trek. So, right before we were recording this, I was up to the episode about Deep Space Nine. It's episode 7, called Dancing with Syndication in the Pale Moonlight, which I thought was an excellent title for this episode, episode of this documentary series. For those not familiar, this is a documentary. It's 11 episodes on Star Trek, obviously, the last 55 years. It's directed by Brian Vaucweiss, whose name I hope I'm pronouncing correctly. These are the executive producers that are doing most of the episodes. It's Cisco Henson, Ian Rumin, Brian Weiss, whatever his name is, and Gates McFadden. I thought that was really cool. In the US, it's on Peacock and Prime Video. So this episode specifically, we got a bunch of crew and cast. We have Nana, we have Ira Stephen Bear, we have Ronald D. Moore, we have Fuck Rick Berman, Annie Robinson, yay, Sirach Lofton, and Nicole DeBoer, plus some other directors and crew and stuff. So I made Lozzie watch this, is basically what happened.
It wasn't hard. You twisted my arm. It was a struggle. Yeah. It's also on...
I have to watch a documentary about one of my favorite shows. That's horrible.
It's on Amazon Prime in the UK as well. So I didn't have to pay for it, therefore I was extra encouraged to watch it.
Oh, yeah, if you had to pay for it, I would have just been like, I'll just sum it up myself.
I enjoyed it. It was an amuse-bouche to the what we left behind, or however that's exactly called,
the
proper Deep Space Nine documentary.
That's the name of it, the Deep Space Nine documentary.
Which is a great watch, I would recommend for everyone. Unless you haven't watched the whole of the series yet, in which case, watch the rest of the series, listen to Matt and Elise, and then come back and watch the documentary after that.
There are some big things that have yet to happen, that if you went from, season 4, episode 25 of this show to the documentary, there'd be some big spoilers that you would get, so... I actually watched that documentary before I had seen any Deep Space Nine, but by the time that I watched Deep Space Nine, actually watching that documentary, I've talked about it on the show before, watching that documentary is what got me to watch Deep Space Nine. But I think watching it before you have any context is different than watching it when you know the characters and then you see stuff that happens later.
Yeah, for sure. But it was fun. It was good to see Ira and Ron and Nana, particularly. Always good to see Andy Robinson, Sirach. I thought it was a little bit light on cast. They couldn't get Colin Moore or Alexander or Michael Dorn. I don't know if Michael Dorn was in the TNG.
Too big for this, I guess. I don't know. No, Michael Dorn was not in the TNG one. Neither was, like, Patrick or Jonathan or anything. Like, it like, the mains. I don't know, really, like, who funded this or anything like that. Like, there's some... I don't remember Rick Berman being in that other documentary.
I think it was much more an Ira joint, that other documentary.
So yeah.
I suspect.
Yeah, that's fair.
He was being much more polite about Rick Berman in this one.
Right, yeah. I do think, there were comments in, like, an earlier, in the TNG episode, a little bit about Rick Berman and how he is basically the reason we still hadn't had a gay character on Star Trek. Like, they wanted to write one in TNG, and Gene had given... I think Gene wanted to have a gay person in the original Star Trek, but, like, it wasn't going to fly. Mm-hmm. So, I think he promised it for the next thing, and Rick Berman was like, no, we'll have moms writing us letters, and they're all like, who cares? Like, should do it anyway. But, yeah. It was interesting because they talk about how with TNG they had such a hit on their hands that they decided they wanted to capitalize on that and do it again. So they had they knew they couldn't have two. Well, they felt they couldn't have two ships exploring at the same time. So that's how they got to this, like, space station type show instead of an exploration show, which I love this format, as we all know. And Ira wanted it to be more serialized, so people, you know, if you're in the same location most of the time, you're going to have more day-to-day stories that interact, like, where everyone's interacting with each other, unlike a spaceship where you're going to meet a new, like, alien of the week or a problem of the week and then never see those people again. But as we've talked about this before, the studio really wanted Star Trek to be the type of show where, like, you didn't have to, if you missed an episode, you weren't lost. You can come in whenever you want. So they didn't really get to be serialized until later when they started Voyager already and the studio started ignoring Deep Space Nine.
Yeah.
We haven't really gotten up to most of that in our show, so I really didn't want to get into the specifics of some of the storylines that they got to have because of that. But basically, Ira Stephen Bear takes over the show, and it does become more serialized.
Yeah, I think they start creeping in. I mean, you can see them starting to creep in serialization into
with the Dominion later and everything.
Well, but you can see them even in later seasons of TNG, right? You start getting repetitions of characters. You get, like, multiple, like, lore stories. You get, like, Wesley coming back for whatever reason.
Yeah, Worf Deanna romance a little bit at the end.
Yeah, you get Deanna getting promoted. You get, you know, start to see some character progression. So it's clear that the writers were
Beverly gets to fuck a candle,
at
you know.
This, right? And I think that the studio and the network were extremely conservative, and there was an assumption that there was only one way to do syndication, which is you do not do serialization. Despite the fact that the most popular shows on TV were soap operas, which are heavily syndicated, the most syndicated of shows. The most serialized of shows is what I meant there. So I think
I knew what you meant.
I think it's definitely clear that they didn't really get a chance to do more than crystals serialization until they got a bit more left alone. And really, the serialization doesn't really kick into, like, series 6 and 7. You're just getting arcs rather than serialization, I would say, before then.
Right. Like, the beginning of season 6, like, that, it's, like, very serialized just from the start. And obviously, I mean, you and I know the last 10 episodes of this whole show are one long, fully, like, mini-series of show. Yeah.
Yeah.
And they said one of the other things with Michael Piller leaving and them having a little bit more freedom and being left alone is that they were able to have more darker stories also. Yeah. So, like, we get, I mean, I don't think it's a spoiler to say we get more into the Dominion War as time goes on. I mean, it's clear from what we've been watching that we're headed that way anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I think even so this season, right? It's just interesting,
yeah.
You've already seen things like... You've seen things like Homefront Paradise Lost. You've seen things like mm-hmm. the Eddington storyline. And I just don't think those are storylines about the Federation that would have been allowed or would have been sort of... And to be honest, they're not Jean stories either, right? Like, Jean wouldn't have...
Oh, no, you could not have done that when Jean was alive at all.
Yeah, but still... It was good. The freedom. I mean,
it's really fluffy. I won't deny that.
Yeah.
I had read the what was the name of it? It was the oral history book. It's actually Mark A. Altman is one of the people they interview in this show, and I think he's actually produces at least one of the episodes. He and Edward Gross. Edited the Star Trek oral history and the James Bond oral history that I'm rereading right now, and he was on there, and like a lot of the stories they talked about in this I had learned from that book. But if you had not ever read that book or anything, I could see, like, my parents were watching this before I was, so I could see it being really interesting for them because it's a lot of background information that they probably had never heard before.
I think it's a really good gateway episode, honestly. I think, as I said, it made me immediately want to watch the full documentary, which I haven't got around to yet doing again yet. But
I think we need to plan a time because we were going to watch it together, and then I wasn't feeling well.
I think it's good. I think it's just a little bit lightweight. And that's fine. That's kind of serves the purpose of the series, right? Which is like one 40-minute episode on each thing, right?
Yeah. Just to give people like an example from earlier episodes in the documentary, they talk a lot about Gene Roddenberry and his vision and what kind of stories, as Lazi was saying, are Gene stories and which ones are not. They do go in on him a little bit with about how he always was rewriting scripts without permission. Like, people would hand in scripts and he would change it before it got made or something like that, or rewrite it before it like finally went to the studio, and they were very straightforward about that, but like they never talked about how he was always trying to like make the women's costume sexier or like have it be like a love fest in a way that was kind of gratuitous, like TOS era, I mean. They like drilled in some of Gene's problems, but not like the whole picture is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. I suppose if I make two last points about it that stood out to me, one was they brought up Babylon 5, which I'll be brutally honest, I wasn't expecting them to do. And I think it's good that they do because it's tough to ignore that. They continue to maintain their line that they knew nothing about it, and maybe they didn't.
Yeah.
Who can say at this point, but I'm glad they brought it up.
Yeah.
And the guy who was the head of makeup seems to be an absolute god amongst makeup people.
He hand
painted all of Terry Farrell's trill spots. At least the ones that you saw on her head, not when she got when she gets her swimsuit out. He did that in 20 minutes, and I'm like,
well, it's funny.
Incredible.
Yeah, because Nicole said when she was hired, because Nicole's character is Trill, and she was like, I can't be in heavy makeup. And they were like, oh, don't worry, it's really light. And she was like, yeah, they were finished in like 20 minutes. And it was very similar to Terry's makeup.
Yeah. All right.
So, I know you're not Matt, but I'm going to answer Matt's normal question.
Do you want me to ask you the question?
Please.
Elise, we ask the question that we ask every episode. Did you remember this episode?
Yes, I remembered this episode. I did not remember that the A and the B plot were like both in the same episode, right. But I remembered both of them distinctly because they're great.
They are great.
It's really funny because I had some initial thoughts that I wrote down even before I watched the episode again, And it was mostly that I love both storylines of this so much, and I giggled that both the I'm dying, here are my body parts for sale, and also the pregnancy switcheroo, they're both related to body parts, and I felt
so good.
I was like, ooh, I was stoned, and I was like, I'm the smartest person in the world.
Yeah, it's a fun episode. It's lightweight, particularly by the standards of the season, and particularly like recently we've had The Quickening and Hard Times, which are like
stab me in the heart.
Incredible but woof episodes. This is much it goes down a lot easier, but is still a lot of fun and isn't totally throwaway, and fundamentally changes the character status for like 4 or 5 of our characters, right? Like, it's pretty
Pretty, it really does. It changes their lives. Just to give a little background information to the listeners, Lazzie has been on a few times for Julian Bashir episodes, and The Quickening was coming up, and he was like, no, I don't want to talk about that one. I'll come on for a fun episode instead.
Funny. I described myself as, I'm a bit of a doofus, and I don't want a doofus all over The Quickening.
Fair. Yeah, I did some episode research, as I always do, and some of this information I knew already, and some of it I did not. This part I did know. So the background to the let's put Keiko's pregnancy inside of Nana is that Nana was actually pregnant when they were filming this, and they had debated what to do. They're like, do we have her have a baby with Shakar? Do we do the thing where we like shoot her where you can't see her stomach so it doesn't look like she's pregnant? And then apparently Iris Stephen-Bear's wife came up with this idea, and everybody was on board. Alexander Siddig was also on board. He is the father of the baby that Nana was pregnant with. So it's just funny that he was so involved with switching the baby, and it was his baby.
Their actual baby's called Django, which is an excellent name.
Yeah, it's not the best name. Sorry. Sorry to that person. Because she was pregnant, and I was worried that she was going to have to be written out of the series, which I think is a fear that women have, or people have, rather, that when they're pregnant, they are going to not be, or going to see as dispensable, but B, like, you know, I mean, obviously it's illegal to fire someone because they're pregnant, but...
Yeah, you should let Joss
Whedon come up
know
with
that.
Ways around it. Yeah. Fuck that guy too.
Yep.
But yeah, everyone loved the idea of the switcheroo, and I think that is great. On the other plot, Armin Shimmerman had said that this was actually one of the most important episodes for Quark, and I think that that's really great and true, because he had to make a really, really strong, big decision in this episode, and I think that that really shows who he is as a character.
Yeah, I'll get into this more in the episode, but I think it's fascinating. I think Quark as a character is fascinating, and most of that is stuff that Armin brought to it, or, you know, Armin built on stuff the writers did, and the writers built on stuff Armin did, and so on and so forth. Yeah, great.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to start with the B plot, the pregnancy swaparoo? I just like saying swaparoo. It's such an awful word.
So Miles, basically Keiko has gone off to a conference, and like Miles is being overprotective of her in her whatever second trimester, I guess she's in at the moment. Maybe not even that.
Paying attention enough to know.
Yeah. Anyway, so he's basically being a bit of a douchebag at first, and in a sort of very 90s stereotypical overprotective.
I shouldn't have let her go.
Yeah.
You know?
It's like,
She wanted to repel for some fungi, and it's like, yeah, dude, that's her job. She's a botanist. Like, what do you want from her?
Yeah, but equally, it's another classic. They went off to a conference and never made
it. never got
because he got sideswiped. Oh,
I thought it was on their way back from the conference. Sometimes it's on the way back from the conference. That's true. We just didn't get to see the conference. That is true.
Sometimes it's on the way.
I don't remember what this case was in this one, to be honest.
That was the first mirror.
Yeah, I think they were expecting.
Was them coming
so. This
back
one they were expecting them back, so I think it was after the conference. Yeah, okay. I don't know. It's not that important.
Yeah.
But there was a conference involved.
So the runabout gets hit by an asteroid. Why they're taking runabouts into the Gamma Quadrant, honestly, I might be a bit like, what are you doing if I was Miles as well?
I mean, I feel like it was fine 2 years ago before you knew what the Dominion was, but like, take the Defiant. Like, what are you doing here?
But then you can't just take a warship every time you want to go to a botany conference, I guess.
Yeah, I guess. You got to get more warships for the conferences. Do not ever build more warships. That is for society and for Star Trek.
Well, I hate to be the bearer of season 6 and 7 news to you.
Yes, I know. And I love those seasons.
Kira gets hurt and thrown against the bulkhead. Yeah. And she's bleeding out, so Julian has to stabilize her, but the baby has something happened to it, so there is only one available change of address. Julian says he could have done it to himself, which is interesting, but he was the doctor, so he...
Oh my god, I just thought if that happened now, all the fucking anti-trans people would be freaking the fuck out.
Well, they can freak the fuck out about DS9 whenever that might.
Yeah. When Kira was lying there on the gurney or bed or whatever in the sick bay, or I don't remember if it was in the hallway or they had already gotten to sick bay, and Miles like looked at her like, tell me everything's okay. She took way too long to answer him, and she definitely like acted as if like Keiko and baby had died, and I would have wanted to punch her if I was Miles, to be honest. Like, it was a little too long of a pause.
Yeah.
I mean, I get now she probably, like, afterwards, she probably just was trying to figure out what to tell him now, how to explain it. But in the moment, like, if I was Miles, I would have been having a panic attack.
So what you're saying is it was a pregnant pause?
Oh, God. Yes,
Bajorans gestate much quicker than humans, apparently. So they less than 5 months. So there is not enough time to move the baby back. So the baby will permanently be with Kira until it gives birth. I like that they talked about giving Kira progesterone and giving her testosterone so that she could have the right hormones. Progesterone and estrogen, so she could support the baby, and that they adjusted the baby so it can take on board nutrients. Like, I know that's sort of techno babble, but it's kind of not. It's kind of much more grounded than most Star Trek random words, so I quite like that they took a little bit of time to, like, rather than just hand wave, oh, it's happened, forget about it, which Star Trek would often do.
I mean, I still think it's a little hand wavy, I do not mean that as an insult, because, like, I don't know if... I did not research in our world if a species has carried a baby for another species. I have no idea. I'm not a scientist. But I kind of, like, don't need all the information, so, like, I'm glad that you're glad that they gave you a little bit of something, but I also am totally satisfied with, we did this, it's happening, that's enough.
Oh, I didn't want, like, 3 minutes of explanation, but just, like, 20 seconds of, like, babble. It was good.
No, I think it's great. It was the perfect amount. I really like the dynamic between Keiko and Kira immediately. After this, like, Keiko is really conflicted. Kira is in the position of she's now pregnant with someone else's baby. And this is the most kind I ever have seen Kira. Not that she's, like, a bad person, but she's so kind to Keiko. And, like, she's just making her feel part of it. And Keiko is really upset, understandably, because the pregnancy that she was having is not going to go the way she expected. Like, she needs to make an appointment, she feels, to see her baby. And that is just not what she was going to be living with.
Yeah, I think she's also a little bit...
I felt stressed and, like, stressed for everyone a little bit.
It was a bit of, like, surrogacy stress as well, right? Like, there's always that fear of what's actually going to play out. And I agree.
Right, Kira, but this also was not by choice. No. I mean, a lot of surrogacy is by choice, hopefully. Yeah.
But I think you're right. Kira's very reassuring. Keiko wants to just make sure that they get to see her and the baby as much as possible. They have her over for dinner.
This is a lovely thing that Kira's doing for them.
Yeah.
And, you know, Keiko and Miles have a talk, and they're like, oh, we should invite her for dinner. And Miles says, like, at first I thought he was being sarcastic, but then I realized he wasn't. He was like, we should have her for dinner every night.
Yeah.
And I'm like, that makes sense. Like, as long as Kira's okay with it.
Yeah.
Because it's... Keiko thinks she's being selfish, and that made me so sad because, you know, things did not go as expected, and that happens, but, like, you're allowed to be upset about it. Mm. I totally understood her feelings. I also really liked that Kira, who I always call Kira, insisted that Keiko call her Nerisse. I mean, Keiko called her Major, and I cringed so hard. I'm like, this woman has your baby inside of her. Like, you can call her by her first name. I'm glad Kira confirmed that with her.
Yeah, to us, Kira is Reacher, but to Keiko, she's Jack.
I was laughing a little bit when Kira was complaining that her back was hurting her, because I feel like Miles was, like, nicer to Kira than he was to Keiko when she was pregnant with Molly. She's like, here... He basically is like, here, this back pillow that we have. And it was sweet, though. I'm assuming that's, like, the 24th century version of a pregnancy pillow.
Yeah, it seemed like a little bit more structural, but yeah, it was good.
Yeah. I actually have a pregnancy pillow from post-surgery. Right. They're great.
But, Kira and Keiko have, like, a little discussion about morning sickness, which Bajorans don't apparently get, but what they do is just start sneezing uncontrollably, which, let's be brutally honest, is very funny to watch.
Oh, yeah, I found that very silly and, like, kind of cute, and I don't think that that's pleasant either, so I'm not, like, sitting here like, oh, that's so much better than nausea. I mean, nausea is the worst, but so it is better, but it's not, like, it's not great, but it is amusing. And it doesn't gross me out when I see it on a TV show.
Anyway, so what they decide to do is to have Kira move
is
in.
Become a thruple.
Wow. I'm all in favor of thruples. I don't think there's anyone on the station Kira would be less interested than O'Brien.
Oh, that's fair. This is totally a spoiler, but there is a scene in, like, a later episode where they have, like, a little bit of, like, there's a tension there because they're, like, they obviously are going to spend more time together. Nothing happens, but, like, in my heart, they're in trouble. We'll get to that episode eventually, but and I did really like her moving in.
Co-parenting Molly now, so who's
are you my aunt? Sorry, that was so cute.
This is mommy's husband Miles, and this is mommy's girlfriend Nerisse.
Yeah, exactly. I see Keiko and Nerisse more than Nerisse and Miles for sure. But oh my god, I wanted to laugh because, you know, Kira obviously does not have children, and I don't think she understands, like, you need to give them strict boundaries. Mm-hmm. And, like, I don't have kids, but I obviously, I'm expert. And so Molly's like, can I play in your room? And Kira was like, anytime. I'm like, girl, she's going to walk in while you're banging Shakar. Like, please do not tell her she can come in anytime.
She'll have her, whatever, testing Bajoran or Cardassian sniper rifles like she does with Zial anytime soon. She's got two surrogate daughters on the station and about to have an actual one. Like, it's a very maternal season for Kira.
That is true. That's funny. I like it on her, though. It doesn't bother me.
Yeah. She looks... She seems... She's very chill, actually. Like, this episode is the most chill Kira has been about anything ever.
Yeah, that's interesting. But you're right. I wonder if... I mean, I'm projecting. But I wonder if Nana was just, like, excited to be having a baby. I don't know. Yeah.
Maybe. Maybe she was just excited that she wasn't being written off the show.
That's probably what it was. I don't really have anything else to say on that B plot, but it's great, and I love it. And there's a funny scene later in that I'm excited about to related to this. On the other plot, the A plot, we have the Ferengi businessman who is dying.
And that is Quark, who has been diagnosed by a very expensive doctor with Doric syndrome. And he says the phrase Doric syndrome so many times that I am 100% convinced it is the name of some production assistant or
I didn't look it up, but that would not surprise me. Apparently, Doric syndrome only affects 1 in 5 million Ferengi, and that made me wonder but forget to look up how many Ferengi there are in the 24th century.
I don't know. You probably think there's like tens of billions of them, wouldn't you? Like, presumably they have colony planets, and I don't know.
Well, the women are not allowed to work, so they probably just like make them have a million children. So they probably do actually have like tens of billions of Ferengi.
Well, there's only Quark and Rom. I suppose Mugi was a one. Was an exception.
She's maybe. a widow. She's a lady. I don't know why I called her a widower.
Yeah, so he apparently has 6 days to live. He shows no symptoms of anything, and he doesn't seem to have any interest in getting a second opinion. Just like, what?
I'm like, are you just gonna drop dead in 6 days? Like, you're all just like walking around like yelling at your brother in the bar about how you're gonna die, making a scene, and you're like completely fine. I do think it was really funny when Rom suggested that he gets a second opinion from Dr. Bashir, and he's like, how good he could he be? He doesn't charge.
We do get a rule of acquisition, number 17. A contract is a contract is a contract, but only amongst Ferengi. So he doesn't care about his debts to war for anyone who's not Ferengi, but he does owe a lot of money to Mugi, to Zek, to Cousin Gala, as usual.
I love Cousin Gala.
Even though you think, like Cousin Gala tried to kill you earlier this season, I think you can probably write that debt off. So.
You're probably even. I do love it.
So Rom suggests that he try and sell off discs of his desiccated corpse, which is a delightful concept. And,
I would buy a piece of him. Like,
which piece of him?
That was meant, I was going to say, that was meant exactly how you would expect it to be meant.
The lobes.
I was sad because Quark's... Yeah, for sure. Because Quark is like talking himself down. He's like basically saying, like, I'm a piece of shit bartender. Like, no one's gonna want a piece of me. And his brother Rom is like, no, you are gonna do this, and it's gonna be great. Then Rom like is at first the only bidder, and he's and like I do love that Quark knows exactly how much is in Rom's finances, where he's like, that bid is exactly how much platinum you have.
He then gets a mystery bid of 500 bars of platinum. And he basically says they're trying to work out who it could be. Rom suggests Mugi. Quark is like, nope, she doesn't like me that much, which was very well delivered. So he assumes it has to be Zek.
Armin's every line in this episode, actually, I think, in this plot is delivered perfectly.
I agree. It's a really good episode for Armin.
And Jeffrey Combs, which I have more to say about shortly.
Get on to that shortly. But yes, so he accepts the bid in case it gets withdrawn. Anyway, approximately 20 minutes later, Julian walks over and says he got a call from Dr. Orpax. He made a mistake and Quark doesn't have Doric syndrome, which Quark is very excited about for two reasons, the most important of which being that he can sue the doctor for malpractice, and the second of which he doesn't appear to do. Like, he probably can do that, like, particularly by Ferengi standards, but doesn't appear to actually do it.
I feel like even if he did, it would end by the end of this episode because he loses his standing, so they'd probably just count his lawsuit. And if he had won the lawsuit prior, all that money would have gotten taken away. And after he loses his standing, he probably wouldn't be able to, like, sue anyone. I bet no lawyer would take it on.
Well, that then becomes the crux of this, which is that the mystery bidder is in fact Brunt FCA, and he is not interested in Quark giving him his money back. He's not interested in any money on top of that, but what he does want,
he tried to give him interest.
Yeah. And
do you think that Brunt and Quark are potential enemies to lovers?
No.
He literally says to him, I have 1,000 ideas on how to defile your remains.
I mean, Quark does just also saying. Dream about Brunt later on as well. So, but there's certainly some tension there. It's the insistence on the, if not pound of flesh, the desiccated discs is definitely clearly to me Merchant of Venice inspired in terms of where they're pulling Brunt from.
So as someone who is not super familiar with that, can you just quickly say why?
Yeah, so Merchant of Venice is a Shakespeare play, so you may have heard Shylock as a character name. So Shylock is a is a lawyer.
The person that doesn't know is me. It's not the audience. It's just me.
Effectively, there's a contract for shipping, and if they fail to complete the shipping, then the lawyer will have wants a pound of flesh rather than money. It's a challenging play because the lawyer is Jewish, and there's a lot of questionable.
Oh yeah, Patrick Stewart played this on Broadway. Okay, so now I'm remembering this from I read the Patrick Star Trek Stewart memoir last year,
right?
And he played Shylock, and he said that he wouldn't probably play him ever again because of the Jewish stereotype.
So there's a number of ways that you can play Shylock. So he's been played for sympathy. He's been played obviously as a demon.
I think he just felt because he wasn't Jewish, like Patrick.
I think that's
himself.
Right. Yeah, yeah. That I think is absolutely right. I think it's way too complex an issue to. And I'm not saying it should be played for sympathy. I think there's multiple ways. Anyway, the situation is resolved by a trick which basically says you can have a pound of flesh, but you're not entitled to any of his blood. So if you take the pound of flesh and spill any blood, you'll be responsible for murder. So he basically gets legal loophole out of it. It's actually a good play. It's not like Two Gentlemen of Verona. Sorry, I'm going off on my Shakespeare hobby horse now. Two Gentlemen of Verona is one of Shakespeare's first plays, and I fucking hate it. But Merchant of Venice, whilst it has a reputation for being a complex, a difficult play, I think is a far more interesting one, and is well worth a read or seeing it performed. Anyway, nice. That's a tangent.
No, I appreciated it because I legitimately, like, until you said the word Shylock, and I was like, Picard, but, like, yeah. Obviously Patrick Stewart. I was like, okay, now I have a frame of reference. So we've talked about this before, but Brunt is none other than Jeffrey Combs. I love all of Jeffrey Combs's roles in every iteration of Star Trek, and I think that my favorites might be Brunt and Shan, the Andorian in Enterprise. I think I'm pronouncing the name right. It's been a minute since I've seen that. But
no, it's definitely pronounced Enterprise.
fuck you. Jeffrey Combs had commented, this was in Deep Space Nine magazine, the official Star Trek Deep Space Nine magazine, that he found Body Parts was a lot of fun, probably the best Brunt episode, and he has said I love the scene where I insist, despite the fact that Quark is not going to die, that he fulfill the contract. That first scene where I show up in Quark's quarters, that was so much fun to do. I loved that moment. It was a delicious moment. So this just makes me feel like we get both Andrew Robinson and Jeffrey Combs in this episode, and that just makes me feel so lucky.
Okay. I have 2 points on that. So the first one is, yeah, that scene is incredible. They are really close together, and you see, like, this is going to sound weird, but, like, the lip work that Jeffrey Combs does is really great. Both him and Armin are fantastic in that scene. And it's one of the things that comes out in the big documentary is that Armin used to have all of the Ferengi over if there was going to be a Ferengi episode, and have them, like, rehearse and have dinner together. And it's such a scene that makes me feel like there was a lot of rehearsal went into this, and, like, these are two guys who really,
like, off book rehearsal. Yeah.
Like, these are two actors who, even though they're playing ridiculously big-eared aliens, are taking it fully seriously. And, you know, you gotta love that. The one thing I will say,
I do love that, it,
that I regretted about this episode was there was no interactions between Garak and Brunt FCA. I do think
now I'm curious
I don't think with Brunt, he will do with Wayoon, I'm sure, at some point.
Yeah, that makes sense. Oh my god, I feel like I would watch a mystery show or even a short where Garak and Brunt have to, like, figure something out together, and obviously Garak's gonna probably murder Brunt at the end of it, but I would watch that.
The other thing that's just occurred to me, because I was listening to your coverage of the Mirror Universe episode the other day, is
the one we had varying opinions on.
It's still not good, but I enjoyed it more than a couple of the recent ones.
Yeah, sorry to reference conversations that were had elsewhere, but before he listened to our episode, Lazzy was telling me how much he enjoyed that Mirror Universe episode.
But one of the things you said was a Ferengi always dies in them, and there's no more Ferengi left, and I'm like, we haven't seen Brunt in the Mirror Universe. Now, I don't think we do, but that would have been fun.
No, that is fun.
But there's a wonderful line that when Brunt is basically spitting vitriol at Quark, what he hates is that he's a philanthropist. He made a generous humanitarian gesture, selling medicine to children, Bajoran children, at just above cost. And he's appalled that his Barstuff get
vacation.
vacation. And it's fascinating because Quark sees himself as a Ferengi in exile, and to me he's like becomes oftentimes extra performatively Ferengi, even though he doesn't really feel like it, because he thinks that's what he should be doing, whereas Worm and Mugi, his relatives, are far more comfortable in their own skin and who they are, which isn't very Ferengi.
And Nog too,
and Nog as well. Yeah, and I think that
Nog maybe most of all, honestly.
But I think the fascinating thing is Brunt sees Quark as exactly the same as his family, and Quark has been fighting against that his whole life, but the reality he is like his family. He's more like his family than he is the general Ferengi populace.
Which is why the decision he has to make is so hard. Like, if Quark breaks the deal, the contract with Brunt, not only he will lose everything and his standing in society, his family will lose everything. So Brunt is like, well, I think Quark's first thought is like, well, you don't expect me to kill myself, right? And Brent's like, no, just you have to hire someone to kill you. And I'm just like, this is insane.
But I think the other thing is, you could make this a Worf story, and it has been a Worf story, with the tiniest of changes. Like, you know, it's an honor thing, it can honor a contract thing. If you lose it, then you lose your, not just your standing, but your whole family's standing. You know, death is considered the honorable way out of this situation. It's an outcast thing. It's about what it means to be Ferengi stroke Klingon. Like, the overlaps, right, to me, between this and a particularly a TNG era Worf story are massive. And it goes back to my sort of general, one of the things I love about the show, one of the things I think is the best thing about it, is you get these outcasts that they're all sort of outcasts, or they're all on the edge of their society for some reason, and they come together and as a found family, which is one of my favorite things.
I will say, to comment on that, one of the reasons why I even like it better, at least at this point, as a Ferengi story, is because we have seen, I mean, I agree with you completely, but I like that it's a Ferengi story, and I don't mean to imply that you don't, because I know you do, because we already know where Worf stands at this point. We've seen a lot of him, you know, over the two different series. And it's just, when it comes down to it, like, I mean, we know because we've seen this before, but, like, which side's Quark going to pick? Is he going to pick what's right to him? Or is he going to, you know,
pick what society expects, right? And I think
it's fun to watch him make the choice.
It is. But also, like, if you know, if you're going to pick one word to sum up Worf, right, you'd probably pick honor or something like that, because it goes on about it all the flipping time. I mean, I might say terrible Klingon, that's one word, but there you go.
I'm gonna say ponytail.
Okay, don't say what you'd say if I'm you joking. Had to pick two things, but but if you said a word to sum up Quark, you'd probably say like duplicitous, right, or like sneaky or something. But this story to me shows, like, you know, he's really not that dissimilar in many ways to Worf. There's a lot of overlap between them. I don't think they will ever be friends, but maybe they should be.
I feel like I like them not being friends, but I would like to see them not be friends and interact more.
Yeah. Anyway, so
who's going to kill Quark? who should he hire?
Does he know any assassins? Particularly ones that pretend that they're not assassins, or maybe they're just tailors.
Perhaps a simple tailor.
Perhaps a simple tailor. When Garak thinks Quark wants to hire him as an assassin to kill someone else, he's very in complete denial that he would ever do such a thing. His mm-hmm. previous profession was a gardener. But as soon as Garak is like, well, Quark is like, no, I want you to hire you to kill me, Garak is so fucking horny about this. It's unbelievable.
I feel like also it was really funny that Rom thought he was going to hire him to kill Brunt. Because that is what makes the most sense to me.
Yeah.
I mean, he'd probably get in a lot of trouble for that, but because he was from the FCA. But
it would he be in more trouble than he is anyway?
Yeah, right. Well, he might be like imprisoned or something on top of everything. Like, it might be like, oh, everything's taken from you, but also like you're imprisoned or something. I don't know what the penalties are there. Once you have nothing. You have nothing and you can't get anything ever again, maybe.
Anyway, so what we then see is an example of Garak killing Quark by breaking his neck, and then we get a list, and Quark doesn't like it because he can hear the bones breaking with his big ears so much. And then we list every way that Garak has potentially tested out killing him, including snapping his neck, vaporizing him, which would have ruined his suit, his disruptor, knives, nerve gas, didn't like the smell, hanging, took too long, poison. He wouldn't eat something if he knew it was poisoned.
I mean, that one makes the most sense to me.
I mean, wonderful scene.
I would watch like a movie length montage of Garrick trying all of these things, like a la like Groundhog Day or something, when Bill Murray's character like tries to kill himself over and over again, like that. I just love that when Garrick like went through all of the list, he also listed Quark's objections to each one, like that. It was perfect reading, line reading. I loved it so much.
It was great fun. So they settle on Quark wanting to be surprised. But of course, him wanting to be surprised means he's then just paranoid every time he goes into a room.
That causes him to have some bad dreams. He has a dream where he wakes up in the Divine Treasury, which is a very ugly building. It looked like Trump's bathroom, like with all the gold and everything.
I think it was also the Tower of I think that we've seen that set before as well. I think it's like a classic Ferengi Nile set.
Yeah. He apparently he gets visited by Gint, who is apparently the first Grand Nagus, but it's really just like Max Grodinchek looking like Rom. It's like Max looking like Rom. Sorry, Max as Rom pretending to be Zek, right?
Yes, doing a Wallace Shawn impression. there's a great bit where Quark is like, "You kind of look like my brother Rom," and Gint is then, "Of course I do. It's a dream, you idiot."
I'm kidding, but it reminds me of the Emissary when like all the people that talk to Sisko are like represented by people he knows.
He was the guy who made up the rules of acquisition. Quark is, and he's like, "You know, they're just guideposts." And Quark is like, "Well, why didn't you call them guideposts?" And he's like, "Would you buy a book called Guideposts of Acquisition?" It's great comedy. And then just as they're talking about the fact that he has to break the contract, and Quark is trying to convince himself of that, "Oh, well, if I had a vision of the first Grand Nagus telling me to, then maybe I can swing that." And then Brunt shows up in his dream and starts strangling him.
I do love when they're all fighting like together and he's like, "Rom, Gint, whatever your name is." I love it.
Anyway,
At this point Quark wakes up and knows what he has to do.
Yeah.
So it's sad. He breaks the contract and he loses all of his possessions, and as does his, I guess, Moogie and Rom have also. I don't think Nog cares. Well, you know, Nog has this his job, so he's probably going
to
be fine.
Nog gave all of his money to Sisko as part of his bid to get sponsored into Starfleet, because he like presented him with.
No, you're saying Nog. Right?
Yeah, I said Nog. Yeah.
Oh, I thought you said Rom. I was confused. But Rom has, I meant Rob. Rom has his. They both have their jobs.
Yeah,
they'll be fine. It's Moogie I'm worried about.
Yes. Yeah. Brunt has a black poster of, which is basically like a plague notice or something. He just flourishes out of his jacket and whams onto the wall.
It's like when the health inspector puts this place is closed. And it looks awful. It's probably like one little bad thing, and it's like looks like they have rats or something.
And it is, and they close the bar. And then Quark and Rom are sat in an empty bar, and Quark has no idea what he's going to do. And then suddenly...
even before that, though, they took everything except for his shirt, and he needs to give them his shirt eventually.
Julian turns up with a case of Alderian or some other brandy that he doesn't like.
Bad brandy.
Bad brandy. Bad question mark, quote mark, brandy. And hands it over and says, well, I don't really want this. I don't really like it. So you have it. And then Jadzia turns up with some really ugly glasses. And I can't.
That her sister gave her.
They make such a deal,
like,
out of
wondering
how ugly the glasses are. And it's really odd.
They said it like three times, and I'm like, okay. I also feel bad that Jazia's sister's taste is like so horrible, because they're from her sister, apparently.
And then,
luckily, the station just in general is like, we have all this extra furniture that we need to store. Where should we put it?
And Quark is like, Commander, you can't do this. At least not without a storage fee. Really small storage. And Sisko is barely in this episode for the obvious reasons that Avery Brooks is directing it, but
yes.
He just turns to Quark and does this wonderful deep delivery of send me the bill, and then he lets everyone fill up the bar again. So we have had a big status change for Quark. Equally, we haven't had that big a status change because he's still in charge of the bar on Deep Space Nine.
Two things. We didn't get much Odo, did we, in this?
No, Odo's in that last scene as well. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it makes sense. It all makes sense to me because Sisko knows that he owes Quark I mean, I know it's been made up a bunch of times, but just for staying open on the station when they first moved in, like, that's part of the plot of Emissary, is just getting Quark to stay and making the station have something fun, making it habitable for people. So it's very sweet that Quark learns that there are other forms of
other types of assets.
And other systems besides capitalism.
Yeah. There was one good line earlier when Quark and Rom are talking to each other, and Rom's like, Quark's like, they'll cast you out too, and Rom's like, I don't mind, care about it. I never really liked it anyway. I formed a union and I stood up to them, and Quark's like, they didn't want to talk. They didn't care about you before the union. They only care about me because I allowed the union. It's just fun, like, brotherly bickering.
Yes. I'm more important than you are.
But yeah, it's lovely. And yeah, he has some friends, and that's nice.
Yeah. People care about him. Mm-hmm. And he cares about them too. Yeah. So, Altair Water, known from Alta on Altair 4 in Forbidden Planet, as well as the... I believe it is Star Trek 3, The Search for Spock, something, McCoy gets it. I don't remember. Matt usually says this part. So, Lazi, who are you thirsting for?
It wasn't the most thirsty of episodes for me, but
in your
opinion. I'm just going to say I'm thirsty, as I always am, for found families. Whether it be Keiko and Miles and Kira, whether it be Dax and Julian and Quark and Sisko, it's all lovely people who care about each other.
I love that. I am thirsting. I know I mentioned this earlier, but Brunt wants to own all of Quark's body parts. And I said he said this earlier, but... I have 1,000 ideas on how to defile your remains is a euphemism if I ever heard one.
I hope it's on a tombstone somewhere.
Maybe it'll be on mine.
And what's the most Star Trek thing?
I know you didn't think it was super hand wavy, but I did like the hand wavy, human baby and a Bajoran woman. It's great. It's Star Trek. I don't need more details. It's wonderful. And I thought just in general was this was a huge creative decision and I love it.
Yeah, I would say the incident of something happening on the way to or back from a conference
Yeah, that's classic, totally probably the real answer.
And maybe the least Star Trek stuff thing is stuff actually changing for our core cast for quite a few of them.
I love that. Well, this has been awesome. I am so glad that you joined me today.
Me too.
For this very silly episode that we both liked. It's always more fun, I think, for me when I like the episode. There are some times when it's enjoyable to shit on an episode, but generally I would rather be praising it. Where can people find you online?
You can find me on Blue Sky at Lozymandias. You can find my podcast, The Asimov Cast, where I'm looking for joy and inspiration in the works of Isaac Asimov, at Asimov Cast on Blue Sky and Instagram.
Awesome. You can find me on Blue Sky, Letterboxd, and Storygraph at Chicken Tendi. That's T-E-N-D-I. You can find my other podcast, which Lozzy is a co-host of, Fang Bangers Pod, on Blue Sky and Instagram at Fang Bangers Pod. That's bangers with a Z or Z, as some may say, as well as anywhere you listen to podcasts. You can find Pod Wraiths on Blue Sky and Instagram at Pod Wraiths. You can also email us at podwraiths@gmail.com. Please remember to rate and review us on the podcatching system of your choice. Thank you again to our editor, Melissa, and DJ Empirical for our interstellar theme song.
And until next time, when Matt will return, computer, remove corpse.